Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the show, some very interesting topics this time of the year. This is where the one fault that I have, among many, I don't mean it like
right.
that. The thing that jams me up the most about sustainability,
yeah.
I can't do it because this time of the year, I so crave grapefruit.
And oranges?
And oranges, but mostly
I like oranges.
Grapefruit.
Yeah.
I love citrus this time of the year. It comes ripe in Florida this time of the year, but not here, of course.
Unfortunately, Florida had a really
cold snap back
cold
in early January.
Yeah.
So.
Well, it's a tough. Farming is a tough business.
No matter where you are.
Yep. Huh. This year especially.
Mm-hmm. But we're going to find out a little bit more about the citrus industry in Florida with Andrew Meadows. He's the director of communications for Florida Citrus Mutual, which is basically like a member sort of co-op kind of. We'll do everything we possibly can to make
right.
your life as a citrus grower in Florida profitable and healthy and good.
And consumers need to know.
They do, absolutely.
It doesn't all come
know.
From Kroger's.
It's, that's right.
It starts somewhere else.
Yeah, and we will tell you
right.
how the citrus manages to grow and finally come to our breakfast tables or not.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, and then Chris Higgins, Plant and Gnome Nursery.
Back Gnome again in Indiana.
So is it Gnome Home?
Yeah, whatever it is. The basic premise here is red twig dogwoods. We've
okay.
talked about it off and on.
Mm-hmm.
Winter color in the yard, one of my things I'm constantly harping about, but there's an animal called the red twig dogwood. It actually comes in yellows and tangerines mm-hmm. and all sorts of colors besides red. But a man named Chris Higgins, I bumped into him just going online again, the Plant and Gnome Nursery. And you mm-hmm. got to talk to a guy who runs the Plant and Gnome Nursery. He's the head gnome out there.
Head gnome at Plant
and
Gnome.
And he's
West Virginia.
A Brit, met his wife in Ireland, and they come over here about 10 years ago. He'll explain all that. But he's got this mail order nursery with a lot of really fun, interesting plants for winter color.
Excellent.
So I can't wait to talk to him.
Sounds good. So that's coming up today on Homegrown. We hope that you'll stay with us. In the meantime, Bob, what is going on in your garden?
Actually, a couple of things. Talking about winter color in the garden, I got this really cool plant from Roy Clem, who's an old buddy of ours. It's an oriental arborvitae called Morgan,
mm-hmm.
and it turns a beautiful purple-blue in the winter.
Hmm.
You know, sometimes those arborvitae will turn...
it's freezing cold.
Yeah, but it's a normal thing. And we talked a couple
color.
Weeks ago, I think, about container plants.
Uh-huh.
What a gorgeous plant this is. It's just the side of looking dead.
Mm-hmm.
It's got enough purple and blue in it to make it look really swell. So just another thing to have maybe in
big
a container.
Big tree, little tree.
Oh, it's a dwarf. It'll only get 3 or 4 feet
so
tall eventually.
Real small.
Beautiful, frothy, light green in the summer mm-hmm. and spring. And the winter, it turns this kind of deep purple.
Cool.
Really a neat plant. So I'm excited about that. And every year, this time we mentioned deciduous hollies, I'm going to do it again. You got to have deciduous hollies in your garden, folks. They're just fabulous. Beautiful, bright, screaming red berries.
Mm-hmm.
Mine last all winter because the cedar waxwings haven't found them yet.
Well, that's the cool thing about them is that they persist. No, deciduous holly berries persist through the winter and nobody touches them for a while because I don't think that they don't soften up or ripen to that desirable point until a little bit later in the season.
And then they come get them.
So it's the beauty of nature.
But if you haven't got deciduous hollies, go mm-hmm. get some.
Yes, I agree 100%.
How about the wish you stay? What's up?
Day after Christmas, nothing in the mailbox except...
Oh, no. Coal?
Catalogs.
Hell yeah.
It was rather remarkable, in
yeah.
fact. I mean, have you noticed that at all? I mean, literally, every day you go to the mailbox, no bills, which is good.
Oh, that's not my
you know,
mailbox.
No cards, no nothing, except like a stack of plant
yeah,
catalogs.
Thousands mm-hmm. and thousands of catalogs.
Mm-hmm. And mostly they're ones that we want and that are good catalogs, so we're not getting a whole bunch of you know what. But this is the time of the year that it really is fun to start thinking about and planning and, you know, marking
yep.
the catalogs. And I get kind of obsessive, so I cross-reference and I see where I can get the better deal. And
obsessive,
you? Know,
you?
Yeah. Yes, trying to save a little money. You know, so if I can buy them all from that one catalog, that's fine. But then, I want to spread my business around
yeah,
a little
right.
bit, you know. So it's this whole little dance about, so I have to take very clear notes so I don't forget or miss to order something. But two of my favorite catalogs, Territorial Seed and then the Wood Prairie Farm.
Yep.
And
both.
We've interviewed him
yep.
On the potatoes before.
Mm-hmm.
I just kind of want to give people a heads up if they are interested in growing potatoes. After several years of every year growing 3 or 4 different varieties,
yep.
I have finally come down to my absolute two favorites.
And they are
Corolla,
bum, ba, bum, ba, bum.
Which is similar to Yukon Gold, but better, I think.
It's a car, too.
And it is. Just it's spelled a little differently, Bob.
Okay.
So Corolla, and then absolutely to die for if you, oh, they're just so good, just roasted in a pan, right?
They are?
The Russian banana fingerling potatoes.
The Russians.
They're
the Russian
so
potato.
Good, Bob.
Wow.
The taste is fabulous.
I'm thinking they're from Russia, just to guess.
The first people that grew them here were Russian immigrants, and yeah. They brought them with them. Yes, indeed.
And they did well for you in the Wishy Estate.
They do fabulously.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, are they small? Just kind of
bite-sized?
They are.
They're like, they're not, well, some can be bite-sized, but like they're about this big. How big is that?
That's about 3 or 4 inches.
Yeah. You know, the fingerling potatoes are the smaller sort of fingerling-like, but yes.
Is there a hammer and sickle in there, too, with them?
No, there's not.
Okay. Just checking.
I know, you're just
checking. I
don't
want Homeland Security just showing checking. Up. To.
But that, yeah, just a little tip there if you want to try some good, different kinds of
Tell
potatoes.
Tell me again. I'd love to hear you say that name.
Russian banana fingerling.
Wow.
And then the other one, which is like your kind of standard Yukon Gold, is called Corolla.
Russian banana is a non sequitur.
Yeah, it sort of is.
It really is.
Sort of like a grapefruit.
Yeah, like Nordic orange.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, well, we can get them anyway, but that'll be coming up in part two. Hey, there's a couple things going on in town, aren't there?
Yep, or close to it.
Close to it. So you can put all of your seed catalogs to good use.
Yeah, this is really a neat idea because people are intimidated or not sure how to grow plants from seed. Mm-hmm. And the Bernheim Arboretum Research Force is having a really good class for people on that very subject. Saturday, January 19th from 9 a.m. to noon, mm-hmm. they're going to tell you how to plant seeds. Hands-on workshop, seed selection, seed treatments, potting mixes, containers, light and temperature requirements.
Yeah.
All those things to grow plants from seed, which is just a joy to do.
It really is. And there's an art to it, depending on what kind of thing you're trying to grow. So some seeds you can just throw in the ground and they grow great. Others need a little special attention.
But you got to contact Bernheim, so check our website or their website after the show and sign up to go learn how to plant seeds.
Yep, great. Another thing that your kids might be interested in, Bob, the Kentucky Department of Agriculture is sponsoring their annual poster and essay contest, and it's open to any students in the state from kindergarten through eighth grade. They're eligible to enter a poster, an essay, or both on the subject of the many different services that the Kentucky Department of Agriculture offers, which, well, probably rural kids understand that a little bit more than some of our city kids, but you are awarded a $100 savings bond if you win, so that's pretty cool. And there's a winner in each grade, so it's not just one winner, but each grade has a winner. So several people will have the opportunity to win that $100 savings bond. You can check out our website at wfpl.org or go to the Kentucky Department of Agriculture's website, which is www.kyagr.com.
And speaking of little people, Miss Wishy, we've got a guy who runs the gnome and plant nursery.
I suspect that he's got more plants than gnomes there, don't you?
I hope not. Interesting guy. His name's Chris Higgins, or Higgins, I guess, now he's in the States. Yeah. He operates the almost classically named Plant and Gnome Mail Order Nursery near Charleston, West Virginia. As the head gnome, he's collected and propagated a wide range of plants, including many with interesting winter bark. He's with us today from his gnome dome in West Virginia to talk about winter bark in your garden, particularly red twig dogwoods. Chris, welcome to Homegrown.
Well, thank you very much, Bob.
Great story. You grew up in England. You met your wife, Shauna, in Ireland, where you were both working at nurseries. You moved to West Virginia and started a place called Gnome and Plant. There's a story there somewhere.
It's really called Plant and Gnome.
There you go.
Yeah.
You started a nursery called Plant and Gnome. Can you explain all that?
Basically, I had less to move or less family members to encumber me than Shauna. So we came back to West Virginia. Shauna was working in D.C. at the time. And West Virginia kind of had the blend of family and outdoors and all of that good stuff that we both liked. So here I am. And Plant and Gnome was started when we started having children. We were kind of like the classic passing ships in the night. I would go out to work. I was working as a landscape designer, and I could meet people after Shauna finished her work. And then we decided that that was a bit crazy. So I kind of just totter away in my nursery now, and so that's what's going on with the nursery.
Well, I'll remind listeners, it's a mail-order nursery. You have very interesting and unusual plants, which is what appealed to me. Particularly, we're talking about winter bark and things like that, and a lot of red twig dogwood. So let's kind of focus on that initially. You've got eight or ten different kinds of red twigs. Why do you have those?
Apart from they're relatively easy to grow, Bob, you know, kind of when I assess the worth of a plant, you know, I kind of like think of 12 months of the year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you could give a plant, say, a point for every month that they actually make a contribution to, say, someone's garden.
That's a good point. Yeah.
And with the red twigs, for instance, you know, some things only flower, say, in the summer, a summer flowering plant, you might only get 4 weeks or 6 weeks of flower out of it. Now, the red twig dogwood, you know, will be giving you something from December through to April. 5 months of color from them. Mm-hmm. So they're a pretty attractive garden plant. And then I also do a lot of floral work, and we cut the sticks for incorporating into flower mm-hmm. arrangements and
right.
Christmas wreaths. And the flower is not really what you describe as a flowering plant, but there is a flower, and sometimes you get a berry, which is kind of good for wildlife. They are a native northeastern plant.
So
now, within the red twig dogwoods, there's a whole range of different colors. I don't know if you want me to...
Well, let's do talk a little bit about that, but let's first get our sorts about us in terms of, you know, we can say red twig dogwood and all of that, but...
What
are they in terms of the species that people would want to look for? And then we can move on into highlighting some of the ones that might have the most robust and interesting colors and such.
Okay, grand. Red twig dogwood is, of course, a common name,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, people use it to cover, like, red twig dogwoods and yellow twig dogwoods, and there's also orange ones.
Mm-hmm.
The family is Cornus, which is the same as the typical flowering dogwoods that mm-hmm. people have that grow in the spring, the Cornus florida, and the, you know, more often they grow Cornus kusa, which is the Japanese flowering dogwood. And then after that, there's several different varieties. Cornus alba, Cornus sericea,
mm-hmm.
and that is more also called as a common name, red osier dogwood. It is very branchy,
right.
and it lays down branches on the ground and spreads like that. So that is actually very good for erosion control. I actually like that one, even though it can become quite a wide, 6 foot wide shrub.
But there's a purpose for that in some places as well, huh?
Well, for erosion control, mm-hmm. but to get the best color on them, you need to cut them down in the spring.
Okay.
The new growth is always the reddest. So if I haven't, say, cut them for floral use, and I've left some for, say, prettiness, I cut them down in the spring anyway. The growth during the summer is always going to be green. It's only when it gets cold that the twigs turn red, and it's really only the new twigs that turn red.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a few members of the Sericea kind of collection that have variegated leaves, and there's yellow twig dogwood, there's red and yellow.
Yeah, I've got a Sericea near my driveway at home there for a reason. I call it a welcome home plant. When I drive home in January and February, here's this bright red bush to greet me.
Yeah.
And I need that in the winter. I don't need that in the summer, so that's why it's there.
Yeah, and, you know, kind of when I do landscape design, I often, you know, I always think white birches and things like that are a great driveway plant.
Right.
Because, you know, it keeps you on the driveway. That is actually a great grouping, you know, is like having dogwood and white birch with maybe a green background.
Yeah.
Good point.
Behind
right?
it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, Chris, one of the varieties, I think, that almost has a little bit of a quality between red and yellow, just in terms of its vividness, maybe because it's more orangey,
yeah.
is the midwinter fire.
Yeah.
And as you've discussed, you get the best color if you cut them back? Can we talk a little bit about the maintenance requirements so that you get the most out of the plants?
I'll just jump in and say something.
Sure.
The Ulba and the Sericea certainly need to be cut back.
Mm-hmm.
The Midwinter Fire, which is sometimes called Winter Flame, and there's a new version called Arctic Fire. That is a Sanguinea family, and that grows a lot slower than the other two. So I don't cut that one back so often. It's true that the color comes on the newer growth, but it's not so productive. And so I would, you know, I do cut that because that is one of the most attractive, you know, it's a standout plant. In fact, I just saw 30 driving on a road that I haven't been on. But I wouldn't kind of give that the same treatment. But the others, certainly in February, March, you do want to maybe cut down to the base, but it's kind of, you know, you can take out a third of the plant every year. You can cut it down to the base, like the whole thing, like down to 18 inches. And you want to, I don't know if you're familiar with the term stool. It's kind of comes from coppicing.
Yeah, coppicing.
When they used to grow, grow a lot of sticks for basket making and hurdles and things like this. But the plant is not going to produce a lot of sticks on top if it hasn't got a well-developed root system.
Mm-hmm.
So initially, you might want to let the plant grow for a couple years before you actually cut it down, because then it's going to get a well-established root system and then be able to throw up more shoots. You know, the longer the plant is in the ground, the bigger the root, so, you know, it's going to throw up more shoots. Whereas if you cut it down in the first year, you're not going to get such strong regrowth.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on what competing plants you've got around your... I grow a lot of them together, so their sticks are forced up, so I'll get maybe 3 or 4 feet growth on a new plant.
Right.
But if I planted it in a bed where there wasn't anything around it, and I cut a two-year plant down, it might only grow up to about 18 inches. So there's, you know, a lot of little variables in there.
Yeah.
Well, Chris, do you know, I just
thought... Does that help you?
Yes, it does. Very good.
Well, for first time red twig dogwood users, what would you recommend is maybe two or three basic plants to get a nice variety in their yard?
Well, if you were planting two or three and you were planting them in different places, then, you know, I would say a variegated leaf of either a red or a green one.
Mm-hmm.
I would say a winter flame, which is the more orange-stemmed one. And if you've picked a variegated leaf of a green one, you could have a variegated leaf of a red one in another place. If they were being planted in the same place, I would say you'd be better planting all of one variety, because otherwise you would have an effect a bit more like, say, hanging out a line of washing. A green one, a red one, and an orange one all mixed together.
That's a fabulous way to put it.
Yeah.
I like that.
But they make a great mass planting where you've got like a collection. And, you know, people always use the magic numbers of 3, 5, you know, odd numbers. But they give you a really great effect if you have at least 3 or 5. Or even more, you know, they're a great plant for the larger landscape in that effect, because you get such a big hit when you have the whole lot together. Mm. But with the smaller garden, if you have, you know, single ones dotted around, and then it's always best to site them where you do have like a backdrop, like a green conifer, or, you know, if you had a red twig, you know, maybe a yellow conifer or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, the plant will look a lot better if it's sited where there's a little bit of contrast with it.
How about full sun and shade, or wet or dry?
They grow well in what I would call most typical garden soils. They definitely err on the wet side. The common name of Cornus sericea is red osier dogwood.
Right.
Osier meaning it likes it wet. They're not so problematical to disease. If they do have good moisture, not maybe good moisture, but a lot of humus in the soil, soil rich in organic matter, and sun is good. The variegated ones will grow pretty good with part shade, but they're certainly not a plant that, I mean, I've grown them in the shade, but I would say more out of the part shade to full sun than shade.
Well, good. Well, Chris, thank you very much. We sure enjoyed talking to you. I want to get over to Plant Gnome sometime just to see your decorations.
Okay, well, you'd be very welcome, Bob.
Yeah. Chris, do you have any gnomes out there other than the kids?
Yes, I do a little bit of chainsaw wood carving.
Uh-huh.
And that is largely my gnome collection. And there might be a few gnomes who come out in the dark and move things around. Always having that trouble. And they're supposed to help you, but anyway.
Yes, indeed.
Not too many of the gnomes.
Well, thanks very much. We appreciate it.
Okay, thank you both, too. Uh-huh.
Chris Higgins is owner of the Plant and Gnome Mail Order Nursery near Charlestown, West Virginia. For more information on his nursery, where you can buy red twig dogwood trees or gnomes, visit our homegrown page at wfpl.org.
Coming up next at the American citrus industry, grapefruit oranges, fresh squeezed and concentrate. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I remain Bob Hill.
And now switching gears a little bit from beautifully colored dogwoods.
Gnome domes.
No, not gnomes. Dogwoods.
Okay.
To beautifully colored fruit.
Yeah.
Andrew Meadows is joining us now to talk about the citrus industry in the U.S., but mostly in Florida. Huge business in Florida, as I'm sure people well understand. Andrew Meadows is the Director of Communications for the Florida Citrus Mutual. Florida Citrus Mutual represents Florida growers in trade and legislative, regulatory, labor, and market affairs. And he's joining us today. Andrew, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's a good day here today in Florida, and we're happily growing oranges and grapefruit and tangerines down here.
All right, and a little bit more, too, I bet. Citrus is not native to Florida, but it's certainly known as being a major citrus state. What makes the state so ideal for the crop, and where did citrus come from to begin with, and how did it land itself in Florida so comfortably?
Yeah, it originally came to Florida in the late 16th century. Ponce de Leon brought it in through St. Augustine, planted it in that area, and mid to late 18th century, it really blossomed into a commercial industry and grew from there into the industry that we have today.
When did the industry really emerge as an industry, and what were the changes or the innovations that sort of allowed it to be, you know, people just growing oranges and selling them out of crates to all kinds of orange juice products that you can find at any given store? Do you know what I mean? It's huge.
Yeah, you know, originally Florida oranges kind of capitalized on the tourist trade here in Florida, and people from up north really saw oranges and citrus and grapefruit as kind of a taste of sunshine. And
right.
Since our season runs in the winter,
snowbirds would bring them back home with them.
Exactly. It was kind of a great delicacy or delight for people up north to get. And, you know, Tropicana, now 90% of the oranges in Florida go towards juice because of their juice content. We do have a significant fresh industry, but the majority of Florida's industry makes juice, and Tropicana, as everybody knows, is the major brand. They really pushed the envelope and started transporting back in the mid-19th century, transporting juice to stores up north in the Northeast and New York area, and they really helped the industry flourish as a commercial entity.
Well, what about like concentrates and stuff like that? Was that something that they did back then, or was that an innovation that came later?
Back then it was mainly shelf-stable orange juice, but mm-hmm. frozen concentrate was invented, I believe, sometime in the 1960s, and that, mm-hmm. again, you know, was an innovation that helped packaging and shipping, and now, you know, frozen concentrate, if your listeners aren't familiar, is basically orange juice with the water removed,
mm-hmm.
so you can ship a lot more of it and then add water back in at the destination point and pack it. So mm-hmm. Certainly that was an innovation that helped flourish the industry. And, you know, further on, maybe about the 1980s, NFC, not from concentrate, mm-hmm. which is basically pasteurized orange juice, which is heated to a temperature to kill the bacteria,
mm-hmm.
And then cooled down, was really took off, and that was another innovation that helped the industry grow. And right now, really, NFC is considered Florida's premium product.
So that's what we would buy in the grocery store that says not from concentrate, that's already, you know, ready to drink, essentially, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
That's
fresh squeezed, as
that is. It's got a fresh squeezed taste,
mm-hmm.
and it's basically pasteurized,
gotcha.
Orange juice. Yes.
Right. Andrew, I'm curious, what happens to all that pulp and rind? It must be tons and tons of it.
Well, you know, very little goes to waste. A lot of that, the vast majority, is made into pellets for cattle feed. So a lot of the processing plants that squeeze it into orange juice also have a derivative business in cattle feed.
That's interesting. Corn and orange rinds.
Exactly.
gives it a whole new sort of meaning, after all. I wonder if you could, like, turn it into mulch and stuff, too.
I don't know. You might be able to do that. If you try it, let me know, and I'll be sure to publicize it.
Well, you hear a lot about vitamin C, but what all is in oranges that make it so healthy for us?
You know, we're obviously proud of our product and think it's one of the healthiest beverages available. It's got obviously quite a bit of vitamin C. An 8-ounce glass has a full day's supply. You know, we also have potassium. Folic acid is a main component, and that's important to pregnant mothers. We all know the benefits of folic acid. We've got quite a bit of antioxidant content as well, and, you know, if you've been following some of the research lately, antioxidants can help neutralize free radicals in the body. So our industry has really been promoting the health benefits of orange juice, a way of separating us, because when you go to the store now, you're literally assaulted with different beverages. Now I've heard statistics that there are 20 to 25 new beverage introductions every month in the grocery store. So we really think we have something to hang our hat on and separate us from the pack.
Let's talk a little bit about the major players worldwide when it comes to oranges. You know, you mentioned the Valencia orange. Do they grow Valencia oranges in Spain, or does California and Florida
sure.
sort of corner the market when it comes to oranges? Who else is growing stuff?
Well, a quick lesson there. Florida, as I said, 90% goes into juice. We have about 10% that goes into fresh.
Uh-huh.
California's flip of that. They basically produce oranges for the fresh market, and
mm-hmm.
then they have a little bit of a juice business. We like to say that's because of the juice content of Florida oranges. With our rainfall and our soils, we really produce a heavy, juicy orange. And if you hold it next to a California orange, it's actually heavier,
mm-hmm.
Because of that water juice content. That's domestically, you know, Texas and Arizona also have smaller citrus industries that mainly produce for the fresh market. Mm-hmm. Now, the major global competitor for Florida in the juice industry is Brazil. And Brazil has a massive orange industry. They produce about twice as much as Florida does in the Sao Paulo region of the country. And they import some juice to the United States, but most of their juice is consumed worldwide. Europe is a huge market for them. The United States is a net importer of juice, so Florida cannot make enough juice for the consumption in the United States, so it has to be augmented with Brazilian juice.
Okay, I see.
So how many acres would Florida be growing, and what's the net worth of the crop?
Florida grows, we're around 600,000 acres, and with prices the way they are to farmers this year, we're expected to be around $1.3 billion in cash receipts.
Is it still growing as a crop, more acres every year, less? Or what?
It's actually been less. You know, we were hit by a couple of hurricanes 2 years ago,
right,
which significantly impacted the acreage. We've had some disease issues with canker, citrus greening. That's caused the removal of 75,000 acres. So we've had a pretty steep decline over the last decade in the acreage in citrus in Florida. Mm-hmm.
What are some of the things that have impacted the price of orange juice in the last couple of years? Because it, you know, it does continue to get a little bit more expensive. Clearly, weather is going to be one factor, but what other things are really dictating the prices here?
Yeah, you know, oranges and orange juice is a global commodity, so it's affected by supply and demand. And the supply side in Florida has been shrinking, as I mentioned, not only because of development, but because of the hurricanes and the pest and diseases you mentioned. We have citrus canker. We eradicated about 70,000 acres because of canker over the last 5 years. And we also have a disease known as citrus greening, which has a lot of the industry concerned. It is a fast-spreading disease. It's spread by something called the Asian citrus psyllid, which is a bug.
Mm-hmm.
And we're concerned. You know, we've got research. We've almost 100 research projects underway to try and find out how we can understand greening, how we can understand the citrus psyllid, and how ultimately we can develop a long-term solution to the disease. But, you know, I kind of liken it to citrus's Manhattan Project right now. It's that serious.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, it, really, not to overstate it, but the future of the industry is at stake, and we're coming together, and we're cautiously optimistic that we can figure this thing out and continue as a viable industry.
Well, Andrew, to that end, how long does it take to get an orange tree in production, and how long will a tree typically last?
You know, it used to take 6 or 7 years to get a tree to the point where you could harvest a crop off it. Now we've actually accelerated that to about 3.5 years.
Yeah. How long will a tree last then?
You know, it depends. There are some really old trees out there with on good solid root stock, but you're looking at about 30 years for the life of a tree.
Mm-hmm. How are they harvested? Is it manual labor or is it all mechanical now?
Yeah, it is manual labor. They, you know, climb large ladders with a canvas bag and dump it into a box, which is then transported to the edge of the grove and then picked up by a truck. And now in the rural highways of Florida, you'll see 18-wheel trucks packed full of oranges or grapefruit heading to the processing plant. So we've also got a pretty focused effort to develop mechanical harvesting. And, you know, more and more acreage is being mechanically harvested, and it's really makes sense for us as an industry to pursue that. It's kind of an interesting process. You have one of the popular models actually has kind of fingers on this whirling machine, and the machine will come up to a tree's canopy and stick these fingers in there, and it'll whirl around, and it'll knock the fruit off the tree into a basket at the bottom, and that basket will collect the fruit and then haul it to the edge of the grove. Another one is a trunk shaker, which actually grasps onto the trunk and kind of gently vibrates the tree so the fruit falls off into a basket, which is then hauled to the edge of the grove. So there's some interesting mechanical systems out there, and that's going to, you know, continue to be a pursuit of the industry to perfect that and ultimately implement it on a large scale basis.
Are there like trade issues when it comes to oranges that you all have to sort of protect your growers from, or
yeah,
you know, watch?
You know, there's a tariff on frozen concentrate orange juice imports, and so we've been very active, Florida Citrus Mutual, with protecting that tariff and making sure that you know, the countries that we compete with, mainly Brazil, are on a level playing field, because they have a lot of labor advantages and their costs are considerably lower than ours. There is a tariff, and we've been active in Washington and protecting that tariff and making sure it remains there.
But just
with
frozen,
that's really one of our core responsibilities.
Okay. Right, but just with frozen concentrate?
Right.
Okay.
I was curious. I guess I sort of assumed that all agribusiness from coast to coast is getting more and more corporate. Is that true in your industry too, or is there still room for a guy with a few hundred acres and a plow?
There is. You know, we've got a pretty diverse industry in terms of growers. We've got some large growers, some large corporate growers that grow 15,000, 20,000, 25,000 acres, but we've also still got, I just was at a grower's the other day who had 60 acres, so we've got across the board. There's been some consolidation, not only at the grove level, but at the processing level as well, but that's really kind of a economic phenomena in the United States, and we're no different. But we're still a diverse industry, and our organization, Florida Citrus Mutual, has across-the-board membership from those 50-acre growers all the way up to 20,000-acre growers.
Yeah. So basically everybody just sort of sells their stuff to the major processors, and it gets turned into our concentrate or our fresh juice or our pasteurized juice.
Exactly.
Yeah,
some do it on a cash or spot market where they sell their fruit for whatever is being offered for it, and some sign long-term contracts, which helps manage their risk.
Mm-hmm.
Most growers have a good mix. Just like an investment portfolio, you have your blue chips and your bonds, and then maybe you have some money that you play around with some higher risk investments. So most growers kind of balance their portfolios that way as well.
This is either a brilliant or a totally dumb question, but you know, green is in now, organic is in. Is there an organic tree as compared to a fertilized tree?
There is organic. There are organic growers. There's an organic farm not too far from here in Lakeland, Florida, and so there is certified organic juice and certified organic citrus as well.
Mm-hmm. As far as you know, is it hard to grow oranges organically?
It is. I've been told by several people that it is, because Florida is, because of our climate and because of the moisture, I don't know if either you visited here, but you know bugs.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Bugs are
lots
a problem
of bugs,
in Florida,
lots
and that's
fungus.
No different in agriculture. So
yeah.
It's very difficult on a large-scale basis to produce organic crops here in Florida. But some, you know, they see the value in it, they see the demand for it, so they're willing to take on those extra costs and extra hurdles to do it.
Yeah, sure. My brother-in-law just sent me 15 oranges from his backyard, so I guess there are people who are doing it organically.
All right. Andrew, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Great, great. Thank you. If you need anything else, please give me a call.
Certainly will. Andrew Meadows is the Director of Communications for Florida Citrus Mutual. Florida Citrus Mutual is a co-op of sorts looking after the best interests of growers in the Sunshine State. For more information on citrus, please visit our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and Miss Wishy's new Latin Word of the Week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Thank you.
special. Bring my baby back. Yeah, bring her right on home now.
Ring the bell, Bill. Ring the bell.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Homegrown to back welcome.
Oh, Lord.
I practiced that for a week.
Did you really?
Homegrown to back welcome.
This are
is,
you?
This is Hillbop.
Hillbop. Hillbop. Is it backwards day, Hillbop?
Sure. Homegrown to back welcome. This is Hillbop. Okay, I got it out of
that
my system.
That scares me, really.
I got it out of my system. Never again,
this
folks.
This is not like some sort of New Year's epiphany you've had. That you're
actually, I met
backwards.
Stephen King in the lobby on the way in here, so I don't know what's going on.
All right. But
questions
yes,
are going on.
We are back, and we have some questions. This one's from Justin. Bob and Janine, my wife and I moved into our first home in August here in the Highlands. We have what I'm fairly certain is a Norway spruce, about 30 to 40 feet tall. The tree has had the lower limbs removed about 8 to 10 feet up the trunk. Many of the needles on the lower limbs were brown when we moved in and have fallen off as the weather turned colder and the winds increased. My limited research suggests that the tree is suffering from Cetosphora canker. Most resources suggest that I remove the infected branches, taking care to disinfect between cuts so as not to spread the infection.
Yep.
Is it okay to remove the branches now, or should I wait until spring? Should I fertilize? And if so, what should I use?
This is a very interesting and really more complex question than maybe Justin. But it's good because we can talk about a lot of things here. First thing I want to say is that conifers lose their needles. People don't expect that.
Mm-hmm.
I have many conifers that the tips are green and fine and the inside is brown.
Mm-hmm.
And that's normal.
And it's normal if it's a nice sort of uniform, you know, throughout sparsely, you can tell. Early winter is the time that it happens.
Yep.
Yeah.
Now, if the tips of your limbs are brown or there's brown here and green here, you got a problem.
Yeah. Major dead.
But there's normally that's just the way the tree is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really, in a sense, hard to know. But we can talk about a lot of issues here, and some may fit. I kind of think he said he suspected canker, so he must have done some research here that indicates there's some canker there.
The best indication for those cankers, though, is if there's some sort of lesion on the branches. So he wants to look for that, right?
Exactly.
And also, to the fact that this Norway spruce has been limbed up so much, he's going to see the interior of the tree that you otherwise would not naturally see.
Exactly.
So it makes me wonder how much of that is a natural sort of shedding and how much of it could potentially be... a disease. It's hard to tell, like you said. It's more complicated.
But it's good to talk about it. And so we really can't tell you whether you remove branches or not. You need to really get an arborist out there, a trained arborist who can tell you, and it's worth it. For a tree that size, it's worth it.
Yeah, no kidding.
As far as fertilizing, no.
No.
Not now.
Not now.
Either way, regardless.
Yeah.
Because you should wait until...
like early spring, basically, for an evergreen.
Exactly.
Which is not the case for other trees, too. So don't take that as across the board for all trees.
So, Justin, we don't really know, but there's a lot of possibilities, and you need to take one more step.
Yeah. Look at the branches to see if there's any lesions or obvious, like, oozing or weird cracks and that sort of thing. Then that may suggest what you can do, too, is cut off one of those branches if you do see a lesion, and you can take it to your county extension agent and they can send it off and get you a diagnosis as well.
Good old Donna Michael is waiting.
Yep.
For
and her people.
With a dead leaf.
Yeah, exactly.
A dead limb.
All right, another question.
From Sharon.
Mm-hmm.
Another interesting question. She had some seeds left over, store-bought seeds, from the past year and was wondering if she puts them in the garden and left them, will they still sprout for the next spring?
Mm-hmm.
The seeds are
musculin,
sweet pea, columbine mix, cucumber, butterfly flower, nasturtiums, cosmos, pumpkin, and the old black turtle bush beans.
Mm-hmm. If she plants them in the ground now, will they sprout next spring? It depends on what you're planting.
Right.
So of this list, most of these things should not be planted now. Most of these things could be planted out in the spring and they'll be, you know, direct seeded, totally easy.
Cucumber and pumpkins, I don't be a bad idea.
Musclin, totally. Sweet pea, totally. Columbine, the cucumber, cosmos, pumpkin, the bush beans, all of that stuff needs to be planted out in the spring.
Right.
Butterfly flower, a perennial. You can sprinkle some of those seeds now if you want. Even with the columbine, you can sprinkle some of those seeds now, too, to see if some come up in the spring. Cosmos, too. What I usually do with stuff like that, I crumple them and, you know, back into the garden when they go to seed, and then I save some as well. So a little now and then a little in the spring just to see, you know. But mostly you're going to want to save most of those and plant them out in the spring, okay?
Okay. The wishy approach. If you have a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org. Call us at 814-8246, or we're still waiting for the first letter of 2008. Send us a letter at 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202, U.S. of A. Speaking of New Year, Miss Wishy, we're going to round it off with the Latin word of the week.
We are going to round. We're going to round it on. Round it up.
No, that's what I meant.
Round
it on. Yeah.
From the beginning.
I hate a bad pun.
All the way to the end.
We're going to round her up.
Okay.
Yeehaw.
Yes. The Latin word of the week this week, in honor of our citrus extravaganza.
Good going.
Globulosa.
Which of course means round or spherical, as in globe.
It means globby.
Globular.
You look like a glob.
I'm working on it. It's the holidays.
Globulosa, globulosis, globulosum, round or spherical. Also words like globulifera, globularis.
Yep.
All of those are going to be pertaining to or, you know, bearing spherical or ball shape things, right?
I'm with you.
For example, Epimopsis globularis.
The old Hoosier Pass skyrocket.
So, like, I have a question about this plant.
Yeah, I do too. 4th of July.
Hoosier Pass skyrocket. Mm-hmm. It's like, does Hoosier, is that only applied to people in Indiana? Or
of
does
course.
That word mean anything else?
It means who's your mother.
Who's your mama and who's your daddy?
Yeah.
So Hoosier Pass, does it have to do with some sort of basketball reference? And how did it get associated with this plant?
I never passed a ball in 40 years, so you're talking to the wrong person. That's a good question.
I'm so curious about Hoosier Pass skyrocket.
There's going to be maybe a Bob plant story
here. Okay, I'm going to put you on that one.
I'll come back with the answer for you.
Epimopsis globularis, Hoosier Pass skyrocket.
Yeah.
Rhynchosphera globularis, the globe beak rush.
That also sounds like a non sequitur. How can
I like
you have
beak rush.
A round beak? What is beak rush?
Beak rush is Rhynchosphera.
Yeah, but what is the plant? You ever see it?
No.
I haven't either.
But Rhynchosphera says beak rush too because Rhyn, nose.
Yeah.
And then sphora,
whatever
rush.
It is, it's round.
Philipteris globulifera.
Holy cow, the globular maiden fern.
Yep. Globularia, which is just the
globe daisy
genus, globe daisy. Artemisia globularia.
Oh, yeah, the purple wormwood.
Of course.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if you see globularis, globulifera, globulosus, globulosum, or globulosa, that's very hard to say.
You're doing fine.
Something about that plant will be round or spherical.
And I flunked geography 12 years in a row, so.
Well, at least you'll know round and spherical from
know.
Now on out.
I know.
All right, well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, a cheesemonger, if you can call a cheese person a cheesemonger.
You're the show, kid.
In Wisconsin, where, of course, they are known for making delicious
Wisconsin,
cheese.
Wisconsin, cheeseheads. Homegrown is produced by the Never Square, Brad Yost, in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.